salvation.
Yes, I admit everything.
That's what I'll speak about.
Yeah, all right. So, maybe I'll start by explaining my abstract. So, there's a whole system of, or there's a whole dogma of how to do computations in topological quantum field theories, and it has to do with you choose an appropriate algebra, often it's called a quantum group, and then you do various computations with it, and the computations involve, if you're talking about knots, sometimes you're talking about other things, but if you're talking about knots, it involves cutting the knot into small pieces, and then then you have to do some computation on each piece. In practice, the algebras are infinite dimensional, so if you actually want to compute anything, you can't do anything directly. So what you do is you choose a finite dimensional representation, and then you do a computation on each piece, using that representation, in that representation. The problem with this dogma, or with this methodology, is that the dimensions of representations grow, or, you know, if you have one representation on each piece and you end up taking their tensor products, which is what you do when you have several pieces, then the dimension grows exponentially very, very quickly. So if you have a representation of some dimension and you take its tensor power, the overall dimension grows exponentially. And so the invariants you wanted to compute take exponential time to compute. I mean, even just stating a vector in the spaces in which you need to make computations takes an exponential amount of information. So anything you'll do will be very, very slow. And what I want to tell you about today is about an alternative approach where instead of representing, well, you do computations without representing. So instead of representing, you approximate the algebra by some other algebra, which is somehow more solvable. And in some limit where you turn off the approximation, you get back what you wanted to get. But in each individual step, you work instead of representation theory, you work with a simplified algebra. And it turns out that computations in this simplified algebra are much, 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 much faster. So that's the overall scheme. And let me get there in time. Anyway, my talk follows the handout. Here are the first four pages of the handout. The handout has 8 pages. I don't really want to go over the handout as it is on the screen right now. I just wanted to say that the first 2 pages is what I will talk about today. The rest is mostly to show off. So basically, a little more mathematics is on page 3, about here. Then there is, I want to emphasize that everything that I do is completely practical. I mean, I'm a technician. Sort of, I compute. A full program that implements everything that we will talk about today and a few more things is on basically these columns here. It's your page 3 and 4. And then, again, just to emphasize that I'm serious and not just playing games, a tabulation of the values of the output of this program on lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of knots are on the remaining pages. But, you know, so the handout is pretty long, but I'm actually only going to talk about the first 2 pages. Okay, well, I should have started with thanks for inviting me to Hefei. Though I have to admit that I'm not sure why, because I'm not so related to Oparad's theory. So, in fact, I was meaning to talk about something else. I was meaning to talk about some generalized algebraic structure or structures that occur within these computations, but at the end, for which these computations are an example. But at the end, I decided that maybe it's better if I'll actually give the example. So I'll mention in passing the generalized or some of the generalized algebraic structures that occur. But again, my main emphasis will be the actual computations. Anyway, everything in this talk, including the video that I'm taking with the camera over there, will be at this URL. And I should also say that what I'm talking about is joint work with Roland van der Veen of the Netherlands, of Leiden, and follows earlier work by Rosansky and by Andrea Overbay. And maybe I should, or sorry, it's still introductions. So back to the basics. So the objects I really, really want to study are, well, here are the candies of knot theory. So these are the knots, okay? And they look a little bit like candies in nice colorful things. And
this is very impressive. How do you make this?
That's a long story. But these are the first 36 knots or so. And the first problem that comes to mind, by the way, is not necessarily the most interesting problem, but still, the first problem that comes to mind is how to tell them apart. So here is knot number 20-something. Here is knot number 20-something else. I don't know. How can you tell if they are the same or not? And then if I wanted to compare them with this one or with that one, how would I know? So the standard technique is to compute knot invariants. So you find some quantity that you can effectively compute starting from a picture of a knot. So starting from a picture of this knot, you find some quantity that you can compute and that does not change when you deform the knot. So that's the meaning of the word invariant. And that takes values in a space where deciding equality is easy. So for example, polynomials or matrices or elements of the universal enveloping algebra of some reasonable algebra, something where you can tell equality rather easily. And then if you compute that quantity for this knot and it comes out 7 or a complicated matrix or whatever it is, and you compute it for this knot and it comes out 9 or a different complicated matrix, then you know that these two knots are different. Okay? Okay, I should say, by the way, that this is sort of a very kind of naive view of what knot theory wants to do. So, it's comparable to saying, how do I tell apart piles of nuts? You know, if you have a big pile of nuts, or and another big pile of nuts, how do you tell if they have the same number of elements? Well, you compute an invariant, you count. So, these invariants are to number theory, like telling number apart. Sorry, these invariants are to knot theory, like telling number apart is to number theory. In number theory, you care about more interesting things or other interesting things. You can ask yourself, given an integer, can you or can you not present it as the sum of 2 squares or as the sum of 4 squares? I don't know, some other. Okay? And in order to answer such questions, you need to have, first of all, operations. So you need to have, to merely ask if you can present a number of, as a sum of two squares, you need to have the operation addition and you need to have the operation squaring. Okay? So in a similar way, there are lots of interesting properties about knots, and since I want to go in a different direction, I will not describe these properties, but roughly speaking, does the knot bound, and can you find a surface of genus 7 whose boundary is this knot? Can you find a surface whose boundary is the knot and which is allowed to have this and that kind of singularities? And in order to state these properties, you need to go beyond knots a little bit into a space which also has operations which allow you later to state these properties. So I'm not telling you in details what are the properties that I care about. I'm only telling you that in order to even define them, I need to speak about things that have operations on them. And again, the analogy is number theory. So a nice portfolio of not-theoretic objects and operations is the portfolio of tangloids and operations between them. So, by the way, the word portfolio, really I should be saying Metahoff algebra and telling you about some generalized algebraic structures that occurs here. But I don't want to be formal, so portfolio just stands for a collection of operations which I don't want to fully specify. Okay? Anyway, so here are tangloids and the operations between them. So what are tangloids? A tangloid is a piece of a knot drawn in a part of the plane. And again, I don't want to be terribly precise about it, but this picture has several tangloids in it. Here is a very, very simple-minded tangloid which is made of a single crossing of two lines. Here is an even simpler tangloid which is just a cup. Here is another one which is a cap. Here is another one which is just an interval. And here is a rather messy tangloid which is, again, a piece of a knot, but it starts here, goes all the way around, connects to here, has two more components, and they're all linked up together. So again, without being terribly specific, a tangloid is a piece of a knot drawn in a piece of, or in a part of the plane. And it turns out that there are operations among tangloids. So, for example, you can stitch two tangloids. So the dot here indicates that, in fact, this big component here was obtained by stitching a cap, by stitching this little hook at the bottom, to something else. The stitching operation is has several indices. So basically, I want the components of my tangloid to be labeled, and then there is an operation called MIJK, which means stitch component I to component J and call the output and label the output K. So if that was labeled I and this was labeled J, then MIJK would stitch this piece and that piece and give together and give you a united piece, which you will call K. Likewise, there are doubling operations. So delta IJK will take a single component, so a single strand, a single piece of wire, and replace it with two parallel copies. Well, so two copies that run exactly parallel to each other. So this particular part of our tangloid was obtained by doubling a component that used to lie here before and got replaced, so it was labeled I, and got replaced by two parallel components called J and K. There is also a strand reversal operation, so perhaps this strand originally was oriented down, and I applied SI to it, and now it's oriented up. And it turns out, there are also generators, sort of the atomic tangloids, and the atomic tangloids are the single crossing written here, so and in fact there are signs involved with the crossing, so there is a crossing Rij, a crossing of component I with component J, with sign plus or minus one, and likewise there are caps and caps, so together I'll call them quaps, so a quap is either a cap or a cap, and again these are somehow atomic tangloids. And it turns out that there is quite a lot of knot theory that you can express with these operations and generators. So, first of all, clearly, all of knot theory is generated by crossings and these quaps. So basically, if you have a general knot, you put all the crossings and you draw all the crossings in the plane. So you use many of these generators. And then you stitch them together using these stitching operations, and then you get the knot you wanted to get. So clearly, these Rij and Ci's generate the space of knots. And you'll have to believe me that with these operations, you can also define various interesting knot theoretic properties, again, the analogs of is an integer equal to the sum of two squares or not. Okay? So there is a lot more to say, but I need to go somewhere else. Okay. You know, one thing I would have said, and that was my original plan, is what exactly these operations make. Okay, and these operations, they satisfy some axioms. Okay, they're operations, but they also satisfy some identities. And here's one of these identities, meta-associativity, and all together they make a Hopf meta-algebra. And I would have told you about other things about meta-Hopf algebras, but I think it's more important to see the example before formalizing the properties. So, okay. Any questions so far? Comments? Okay. So, my strategy now, or the way I want to get invariance now, is, I want to find a comparable collection of spaces with a comparable collection of portfolio of operations between them, and my hope will be to find a homomorphism from this portfolio of operations, this meta-Hopf algebra of tangloids into an alternative one. The standard quantum group theory strategy is to go as follows. So you look for a vector space U, and really, generally speaking, this vector space is very complicated and infinite dimensional, and I'm using the name U because it's like the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra. So you find a vector space U, and corresponding to a tangloid with a certain set S of components, so if you have a tangloid with a certain set S of components, you will try to map it to U raised to the tensor power S. And then you need operations between tensor powers of this space U.
So you need, for example, an operation going from u to the power jk. So u to the power jk really means u to the second tensor power, except that I label one of the factors j and one of the factor k. Okay? So I need an operation which I will call mjki going from u to the power jk to u to the power I. And normally you would call such an operation a product. Okay? I need an operation going from, so this would correspond to the stitching of two strands. I need an operation going from u to the power I to u to the power jk. Let's call this operation delta ij. And this should correspond to the doubling of strands. And again, in Hopf algebras, you would normally call it the coproduct. I need an operation corresponding to strand reversal, and it goes from u to the tensor I to u to the tensor I. Let's call it Si, usually called the antipode. And I actually also need two special elements corresponding to the generators. And, well, one way to view an element is to say that it's a map from the ground field into the space where this element is supposed to live. So I also need a map from u to the tensor, the empty set, so u to the zero tensor power of u, which is just the ground field, into u to the jk, and let's call this map rjk, and that's the thing that corresponds to the crossing. And finally, I need a map from u to the tensor 0 to u to the I, and let's call it ci. Okay. If you give me this information and certain axioms, which I'm not specifying, are satisfied, like the associativity of multiplication, a certain equation or certain equations that the RJKs have to satisfy. So basically, if you give me that much information which satisfies the right properties, I can compute knot invariants. And in fact, I can compute knot invariants that are well behaved with respect to the operations that I care about, and therefore, in principle, I might be able to say things about the knot properties that I care about, being of ribbon knots, being of genus G, whatever it is. Now, the problem is, so quantum algebra does just that. So the subject of quantum groups produces such spaces and such operations. And the only problem is that Z's U's tend to be infinite dimensional and very hard to work with in practice if you actually want to do computations with them. And so the invariants that you get using this strategy turn out to be very, very difficult, at least in a computational sense. It takes a long time to compute them. Okay? So let's try to do something about it. So the first step is, it turns out that all of these algebras U that you encounter are PBW algebras, which mean that once you choose a set of generators for the algebra, it becomes isomorphic as vector space to a symmetric algebra by essentially by ordering polynomials. So in other words, the U's that I care about, for each such U, you can find a basis, which is some finite set B of generators. So let's say B consists of Y, X, and then maybe more generators. And then there are morphisms. Let's call this morphism the ordering morphism in an order which is specified here in the subscript. So the ordering, the YX ordering morphism goes from a symmetric algebra generated by B into U, and it simply maps any polynomial. So the symmetric algebra is the same as the algebra of polynomials. So it simply maps every polynomial in the generators to the same polynomial, but U itself is not commutative, so it's the same polynomial written in the order where all the Y's appear all before all the X's, and so on. So, a property of the algebras that I care about is that these ordering morphisms are always isomorphisms on the level of vector spaces. So, corresponding to the diagram that I have had above, I have a second diagram made of symmetric algebras. So, if you have a single copy U of the algebra and you raise it to the tensor I, which just means that you label it I, the corresponding space will be a symmetric algebra on BI, where BI is simply the set B where you add a subscript I to each of the generators. So the generators will be YI, XI, and so on. Okay? The symmetric algebra corresponds to U to the tensor JK will be, so now I take two copies of the basis. One copy sits in the JSON tensor factor is identified by having a subscript J, and the other copy sits in the K-th tensor factor and is identified by having a subscript K. And similarly, well, for the U to the tensor empty set, I just take the symmetric algebra on the empty set, and likewise here. And I can, using these ordering operators, the moment I choose an order, I can pull back the operations from above to below, and I get operations between symmetric algebras, same collection of operations. There is a CI, there is an RJK, there is an MIJK, there is a delta IJK, and there is an SI. And I want to know how to compose such operations. So how to take several copies of RJK and then compose it with various stitching operations and whatever else, so that I will be able to make to carry out computations. And I'm afraid I lied to you a little bit and I have to retract. So I didn't really mean symmetric algebras, I meant completed symmetric algebras. So these spaces are really infinite dimensional. And, not even infinite dimensional. They tend to have a topology. They tend to have to be completed. When I said polynomials, I really meant power series everywhere. Okay. Yes?
I understand what is symmetrical, but can you tell us what is really the U, this algebra?
At the very end.
Okay.
At the very, very end. Because the techniques, the way I compute things, in fact, depend only lightly on what U is. I get certain input from what U is, but the techniques depend very lightly on... So now I need to know how to... Yes?
What's your U hat? U is a space. What's U hat?
Some completion.
Some kind of
completion. Yeah. Okay. So now I need to understand, so the next thing that I need to understand is homomorphisms between a symmetric algebra or maybe a completed symmetric algebra on one set of generators and a symmetric algebra with another set of generators. So in principle, B and B prime might be, so B might be a single copy of the original collection of generators, and B prime might be two copies of the original set of generators, or maybe the other way around. So homomorphisms from S of B to S of B prime is the same or as S of B dual in a tensor S of B prime, you may complain that I'm pretending that things are finite dimensional, whereas they are infinite dimensional. In fact, the complaint is justified. I am pretending that things are finite dimensional, and somehow the whole problem will be to figure out how to work with power series and how to make sense of it with specific power series that we will need. But first I want to continue pretending that things are finite dimensional, and then once I see what are the power series that I need, I will tell you how to work with them. What are the actual power series that I need? Anyway, a homomorphism between two such symmetric algebra is an element of S of B dual tensor S of B prime, and the dual of a symmetric algebra is in itself a symmetric algebra on a dual set of variables. So I know this is very, very easy, but I want to spend some time on this. So whenever you have a collection of generators, let's call them Zi, which live in some set B, I will define B dual to be simply a collection of generators with the same name but with a star appended, so these will be the dual generators. And in fact, my convention will be that for elements in B, I will always use Latin letters, and so for elements of B star, I will always use the corresponding Greek letters. So the dual of Zi will be called Zi star, or alternatively Zeta I. Okay? Now, there is a pairing between Greek letters and Latin letters, and it is defined as follows. The pairing of Zi with Zeta, Zi to the M with Zeta I to the N is 0 unless N is equal to M, and if the powers match, you basically count how many ways each of the Zi's here can be paired with each of the Zeta I's here, and that's a factorial, so the answer is delta Mn times N factorial. And more generally, a product of Zi to the Mi paired with a product of Zeta I to the Mi to the Ni, and I don't know what, sorry, there is some typo here. I can't even read how this was created, but anyway. The result will be so basically all the powers have to match, and you get a factorial for each index. So this allows you to identify a symmetric algebra, the dual of a symmetric algebra with a symmetric algebra on a dual collection of variables. And the next thing to do is to say, well, the symmetric algebra on B star tensor, the symmetric algebra on B prime is the same as the symmetric algebra on the union of these two sets of generators. And again, I'm ignoring issues of convergence, completeness. And this is simply the set of polynomials in variables zeta I and zi prime, well, the prime because it came from B prime. So really, every homomorphism between one symmetric algebra and another corresponds to a power series or a polynomial in two sets of variables. Greek letters for the incoming algebra and Latin letters for the outgoing algebra. I think I want to go back to this side of the board. So by the way, a different way of saying this, if I want to pair a function in the symmetric algebra, so now I'm thinking of it as a polynomial or as a function, so a function in the symmetric algebra in the Zi's,
with a function in the symmetric algebras in the zeta eyes. So their pairing, well, just read it off here, is, well, the same as replacing every Latin letter in F by a differentiation with the corresponding, with respect to the corresponding Greek letter, evaluating it on G. I mean, G is made of Greek letters already, and evaluating the result at the zeta I is equal to zero. This gives you exactly the same delta functions and factorials, and equally well, you could have replaced the Greek letters in G with differentiations with respect to Latin letters, evaluate it on F, and evaluate this at zeta I equal to zero. And then the next thing I want to understand, again, my purpose is to compose such morphisms. So the next thing I want to understand is how to carry out a composition. So suppose I have F, which is a polynomial in a power series in Greek and Latin prime, G, which is a polynomial or a power series in Greek prime and Latin double prime, because I go from B to B prime to B double prime. How do I compose them? Well, I have to pair in the middle. That's what composition is. And if you think about it, it becomes, so the power series correspond to the composition G circle F, or a better notation is F followed by G. So the power series corresponding to this is obtained from the power series of G and the power series of F by taking the power series of G and replacing every Greek prime letter in it with the corresponding differentiation, and then evaluating at Latin prime is equal to zero. A different way to see it is to think that F has kind of input variables, which are Greek letters which appear on the left and Latin letters on the right. G has Greek letters on the left, Latin letters on the right, and the way you compose is by summing over all possible ways of gluing Greeks to Latins. And I'm glad there are no Greeks or Latins to complain about it. So by gluing Greeks to Latin in all possible ways, such that the subscript match. So Z prime 2 must be, in the example here, Z prime 2 must be glued to zeta prime 2. So there is only one way to do it. But there are two variables with subscript 1. So I sum over the two ways of gluing, and that gives me the 2 factorial. Okay. I'd better give a few examples. So the first example is the identity tensor, the identity map, going from polynomials in Z to polynomials in Z. The corresponding, the power series corresponding to it, I claim, is an exponential. In fact, an exponential of a quadratic. It's e to the z times zeta. Indeed, well, it's a lovely exercise, you can check it, but indeed, if you read out what the exponential of z times zeta is, well, it's, the first term is 1, which roughly corresponds to an empty box. Sorry, the zeroth term is 1. The first term is z times zeta, which means zeta on the left, z on the right, and a line connecting them. The second term is z squared zeta squared, which can be multiplied by 1/2, which can be represented like that, and so on. And if you glue such a thing to the left or to the right of any box, you get the original box. The input just becomes the output of the original box becomes the output of the composed thing. And the factorials in the denominators in the exponential exactly cancel the factorials that appear in the pairings. So the identity map is represented
by a Gaussian, and this is the single variable identity map. And if you have a multivariable identity map, it's represented by, for similar reasons, it's represented by e to the z1 zeta1 plus 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 up to e to the zn zeta n. And by the, are we okay? Mm-hmm. It's all very, very basic. I know it's all very, very basic, but it's way better than the old ways of doing things. Okay. Here's a little claim. So if you have a linear map from SB to SB prime, then the power series corresponding to it, or the polynomial corresponding to it, F tilde, is F applied to the exponential of basically F applied to the identity map. Okay? Let me see what it means. What it means is that you expand this exponential. The z's in the exponentials, the z's that you get, you'll get sort of a polynomial in the z, or a power series in the z's, with coefficients which are zetas. The z's corresponds to element of S of B. So you can apply F to them, and you'll get elements of SB prime. So this at least lives in the right place. And by the way, what I said now is essentially written out here. And you know, other than that, I think the proposition is pretty clear. But what it means is that if you want to compute any one of the operations that appear here, it's enough to compute them on exponentials. Everything else automatically follows. So let's do a few examples. So the archetypal multiplication map. So the multiplication maps that I care about are much more complicated. But let's start with a simple example. So if you have just the standard multiplication map in symmetric algebra, so if you have a symmetric algebra in Zi and a symmetric algebra in Zj, and you want to multiply the two polynomials that you get here, so as to get an output in a symmetric algebra in a single variable zk, what is the corresponding tensor? The corresponding power series. So the multiplication map is actually simply a variable rename map. All you do is you take the variable Zi and call it Zk, and the variable Zj and call it Zk. So, you know, a different way of saying that you multiply Zi cubed with Zj squared and get Zk to the 5 is that you simply rename all the variables Zk. So the proposition before tells you what the corresponding power series will be. Namely, all I have to do is I have to take the identity map in this space. The identity map in this space, this is J, sorry. The identity map in this space is, I think I'm already running out of useful board space. So the identity map in this space is e to the zeta I zi plus zeta j zj, and apply to it the operation. The operation identifies zi with zj and zj with zk. So after you apply to it the operation, you get
e to the zeta I plus zeta j zk. And so the power series corresponding to undeformed multiplication is the Gaussian written here. Okay. Similarly, there is a, by similar logic, you can find that the archetypal coproduct becomes, so just the standard coproduct of the symmetric algebra, becomes, well, the power series corresponding to it is e to the zj zk times zeta I. And if you look at it so far, we've only seen we've only seen Gaussians, okay? And the next part.
I have to warn you that you have like 5 minutes to go.
I know. Okay. I'm running out of time. So the next part is grayed out because I don't want to spend much time on it. But I'll just say that if you look at the R matrices, the typical elements that occur in them turn out to also be Gaussian, except in two Latin letters. And various commutation relations, in particular the Weyl commutation relations of quantum mechanics, but sort of similar commutation relations occur when you look at whatever algebra you're looking at, ends up leading to quadratics, to Gaussians, in which two Greek letters appear. So the moral is that you need to learn how to compose Gaussians. Okay, you need to learn how to apply basically these composition formulas, where F and G, where F tilde and G tilde are both Gaussians. I've gone way too slow. I'm terribly sorry, but I'm really running out of time. I think I'll skip I'll give a very condensed version of the rest. So basically, what turns out is that in the algebras we really care about, these were baby examples, the examples I gave before. In the algebras we really care about, the formulas that occur are Gaussians with perturbations. So these are the actual formulas for a certain algebra that we care about, Q, U, Epsilon, which I'll mention in a minute. So we need a mechanism for composing perturbed Gaussians, and it's very similar to similar mechanisms that you may have seen in quantum field theory, though it's a bit different. The operations are not quite integration, it's pairing, but it comes out very similar. So we have explicit formulas which have explicit implementations for how to compose perturbed Gaussians. And maybe the last thing I have to tell you, and I've completely switched the speed, if you noticed, is where do these perturbed Gaussians come from? And the answer is that they come from not quite SL2, but something that approximates SL2. So it turns out, so if you have a semi-simple algebra, it always decomposes, well, with sort of an extra Cartan factor, but it always decomposes as its lower Borel sum its upper Borel, and it turns out that if you know just one of them, you can recover the rest. And then there is a systematic way in which you multiply all the structure constants of one of the copies by epsilon, and then the result is not quite the original algebra, but an approximation thereof, which becomes better and better the bigger epsilon is. If you do the standard quantum algebra game using algebras of this form, where you've multiplied some of the structure constants by epsilon, you get a quantum algebra portfolio like I wanted, and in which all the structure power series are indeed perturbed Gaussians, where epsilon is the perturbation parameter. And again, I didn't have the time to tell you why, but the computations in this universe turn out to be way more efficient than using representation theory. I'm terribly sorry. I ran out of time a full minute, and I didn't cover hardly anything of what I intended to cover. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for coming off. Any questions or remarks?
Yes.
Okay. Can we just treat the space of words as some kind of output and then use to get it's just an algebra of such a output?
Not precisely, no. However, the space of knots or more precisely, the space of tangloids, and in fact, even this is not quite precise, but something near the space that I've shown. So, roughly speaking, the space of tangloids is a Hopf meta-algebra, which is an algebraic structure, kind of a new kind of algebraic structure that deserves a name, that deserves an explanation. And again, it's closely related to operads, but it's not quite an operad. And both tangloids are an algebra over that structure, and the U's. Okay? So,
Okay, so maybe I just agree that this crossing enters in the form of R matrix to the picture. Right?
Sorry?
That the crossing of these two strands enters in the form of R matrix. Your picture, right?
Yeah.
Somehow you didn't mention it, but I think it was clear.
I think I did mention the crossing and there are.
Okay. Fine. So I think that we may thank again. And since we start